Good morning and welcome to Shattering Myths. I am Yada. Each weekday here on GCN, we strive to expose the deadly and destructive myths that are associated with religion and politics, with patriotism in the media, and with military and economic schemes. Instead of merely presenting the news, our mission is to understand what is actually occurring behind the headlines while predicting how these events will shape our world. Then, during our second hour, we're going to engage God on His terms, which surprisingly isn't faith or belief, but instead evidence and reason, since His is the lone reliable, credible, rational voice in an exceedingly troubled world. Over the next 2 hours, if you'd like to participate in this conversation, please join us. It's toll-free, 877-300-7645. We spent a good portion of our program yesterday speaking about Bradley Manning. And during that time, I shared with you the three types of documents that this PFC released via WikiLeaks. They contained the strategies that were deployed during the Iraq War, which was over. Pretty hard to be aiding the enemy by giving them strategies after you have left the field of conflict. The second group was the kind of a ground view of the operations in Afghanistan, which is interesting because our time there has been so counterproductive and the U.S. military has been so disingenuous with information coming out of Afghanistan. The same thing was true with Iraq. Almost every early military report on American fatalities was not only untrue, but the opposite of what they claimed was actually true. And so he provided the data that showed insights into past raids that had been conducted and communications between the various parties that basically showed that the Pakistanis were actually working against the U.S. and that the U.S. was completely aware that there was no chance whatsoever of prevailing in that war and that the Afghani government was stunningly corrupt. That's really the information that became available in the WikiLeaks regarding Afghanistan, that the U.S. government and military recognized the war could not be won. Now, number two, and yet still continued to sacrifice money and blood there. Number two, that the Afghan government was like the Vietnamese government that we propped up, amongst the most corrupt on planet Earth, and therefore not worthy of our sacrifice. And number three, that our partners in this war, the Pakistanis, were actually working against us. Now, that's actually not aiding the enemy. Because in those cases, the enemy, the Afghan government that we propped up, the Pakistanis, were exposed. It should have been a godsend to America. And the U.S. military and the administration should have promptly announced to the American people the realization, the acknowledgement that the war could not be won, and therefore there was no reason whatsoever to continue to sacrifice blood and coin. When is it that we are so adverse to the truth that the exposure of the truth is considered helping the enemy? Now, the third aspect of what he released was communications between members of the U.S. State Department. And the thing that was so interesting about those is that they showed that the U.S. government was remarkably immoral, that it was very seldom doing the right thing for the right reasons. We are extraordinarily manipulative. We're like the big bully in a classroom. And that's really what they exposed, is that our State Department is really a bunch of rude children, that rather than bringing credit to the United States, rather than providing a service that Americans would be proud of, that they could walk in a foreign country with their head up high and their chest out. You know, I'm an American, and look at the wonderful things that we are trying to do around the world. The State Department was embarrassing us. Well, that's what he revealed. Now, in a normal, reasonable, fair judicial system, he would have been applauded for that. We would have been having parades for him giving us that information, but not in a military court. You see, this PFC's primary mistake, and now I'm being nitpicking here because the fact that he is a great servant of liberty, of justice. But his mistake is he should have left the military before providing this information. By the way, it's interesting, too, that when he first got access to the information, he went to the Washington Post with it. And here's stunning insights that are extraordinarily valuable to the American people. And the Washington Post says, no, we're not going to do it with it. No. Tells you the Washington Post is in cahoots with the very government that is destroying America's credibility, making America more vulnerable. Well, he surrendered all rights, Bradley Manning did, when he became a member of the military. It's the least free institution on planet Earth. He surrendered his freedom. He surrendered his conscience. And he surrendered his right to a fair trial. And this is what happened to him. However, I would like to ask the American government and its military a question, its State Department a question. If your secrets, if your dirty laundry, if your lies are available to a PFC and to a lowly contract worker in the case of Snowden, who is to blame for that? You know, if you leave your house unlocked and you've got stolen property that belongs to the people in the neighborhood prominently displayed, and the people come and take what is theirs, who's to blame for that? Well, that's really what happened here. The second statement by the U.S. government that appeared in today's SRN News I want to comment on. Our Secretary of State said that that they're still sitting down at the table, even though there's going to be a two-week break in their discussions, and that this is going to bring an end to the conflict and an end to the claims. All right, there's two parties there. One is responsible to end the conflict, but they can end the conflict by just stop being terrorists. If they stop attacking and killing Jews, Israelis, the conflict is over. This conflict has been one-sided forever. The conflict began when Muslims first started attacking Jews in Yathrib, today's Medina, where Muhammad systematically hunted each of the three tribes that made up two-thirds of that community, casting the first out in the deserts to die, later killing them at Kabar, raping their women, enslaving their children, murdering the men, stealing their property both times in Yathrib and then in Kabar, and then being even more savage with the next two communities. One day, killing 900 men, cutting off their heads in front of their wives, mothers, children. That's how this conflict began, and it hasn't changed. When Israel was given 0.2% of the land that was given to Muslims following World War I and World War II, the Muslims couldn't tolerate that, and they began a conflict against the Jews, and they attacked them savagely in 1948. And then in the Six-Day War, and then in the Yom Kippurim War, and then through a ongoing siege of uprising, intifadas. So if the conflict is to end, all the Muslims have to do is stop attacking Jews. It's over. They don't need anything else. And shouldn't that, just doing the right thing, be enough for them? And what claims does the United States want Israel to end? The claim that Yahweh in the Torah, as part of the covenant, gave this land to them? Is that the claim they want to end? Whose side is the United States on? You know, it's interesting. If I was the Netanyahu and the U.S. said that I want you to sit down and negotiate with these mythical people known as the Palestinians, the first question I would ask, what do they have that I want? What can they offer me? Why should I give them anything? What do they have to give me in return? Tell me one thing that they can give me that has merit. One thing. They want land for promises, right? But what does the Quran say about a treaty made between a Muslim and a non-Muslim? Read the ninth surah. A treaty between a Muslim and a non-Muslim is not binding on the Muslim. So what do the mythical people known as the Palestinians have to offer Israel? Promise of peace? That's worthless. But a promise that Israel has the right to exist? It's worthless. Any agreement made between a Muslim and a non-Muslim is not binding on the Muslim according to Allah. There is nothing, absolutely nothing, these wretched terrorists known as the Palestinians can offer Israel. So what is there to negotiate? About a week ago, I briefly referred to a story in the news, began to share it, and it was a story that we only got two paragraphs into, and had other items in the news come up, but I'd like to return to it, and we're going to do it after the break. It is an insightful story because it shows a change in U.S. behavior, not in terms of us manufacturing our next enemy, because that's what we're doing here. It's that typically there is a time lag between the time we make our enemy and the time we attack our enemy, and there is no time lag here. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. I'm your host, Yetta. The topic I want to turn our attention to is the Pakistan, Taliban, and Syria. Now, the Pakistan Taliban is a terrorist, an Islamic terrorist organization that the United States deployed back in the Carter administration when Zbigniew Brzezinski came up with this harebrained idea. It's based upon the Shenzhou philosophy. Shenzhou is the Chinese philosopher and general who wrote a book called The Art of War. And in The Art of War, one of his pillars or planks was the enemy of my enemy is my friend. It also is based a bit on Machiavellian thought. Machiavelli was a nobleman in Italy that was trying to help family members expand their wealth and influence and power by effectively controlling the Catholic Church and having his family members have claims to being Pope. And while he didn't write it in exactly these words, the gist of Machiavelli's approach was the ends justify the means. If you are the most fearsome, the most ruthless individual on the planet, if you carry the biggest stick, if everyone is afraid of you, and if you have shown in the past that you are capable of ruthless acts, people will fear you and those who fear will obey. And so his comment was the ends justify the means. Using that strategy, Zbigniew Brzezinski convinced Jimmy Katta that it would be a clever ploy to go to the Pakistani government and through their ISI to fund the ISI's Taliban, The Taliban was an agency of the Pakistani government created expressly to undermine the Soviet influence in Afghanistan. And it wasn't just because Muslims always want to expand their territory. It was that with the gas and oil reserves having been discovered in the Caspian Sea area, the only way to get them to a free water port other than through China, which China is going to use the oil themselves, or through Russia, and they're going to use the oil themselves, is to put a pipeline down through western Afghanistan. So the Pakistanis recognized that if they could control Afghanistan, they could get the pipeline built, and that it would then come through Pakistan. They could tax the oil that was coming across their territory. And so they created the Taliban expressly to undermine the Soviet-backed government in Afghanistan. So Zbigniew Brzezinski said, you know, we recognize that the Soviet Union has been aiding and abetting the Vietnamese, the North Vietnamese, and have been killing Americans in Vietnam. Why don't we give them a taste of what they gave us, and let's arm and aid the Pakistani Taliban? And so they went to the Pakistani government and a series of meetings with the prime minister and with the heads of their military and the ISI, who controlled the Taliban, who were responsible for the Taliban. And we provided billions of dollars worth of weaponry and aid to the Pakistani Taliban. And eventually they created a civil war in Afghanistan where I think a couple of million people died. I mean, it was a savage civil war. In fact, Jimmy Carter was so enraged by the civil war and the deaths in Afghanistan, he boycotted the Moscow Olympics. Now, what he didn't tell the American people is that he started that war deliberately and purposefully. But anyway, America supplied missiles and weapons and all sorts of weaponry to the Taliban through the Pakistani government. We created the Taliban. And then years later, when George W. Bush, King George II, decided that he needed a war to shape up his credentials, to make him popular, he decided that we would go and fight the Taliban, that, well, declare war on the Taliban because they were harboring al-Qaeda. And so enough he did. So the very enemy that we manufactured, we went to war against in Afghanistan, the Taliban. Now, what's interesting is that over time, we have come to realize, and there's been lots of documents, many of them in the WikiLeaks documents that were provided by Manning, is that we realize that the Pakistani government is still in control of the Taliban. In other words, we are providing weaponry and arms, billions of dollars a year, to the Pakistani government, and then we're fighting the Taliban, which the Pakistani government is equipping. But while that is simultaneously manufacturing your enemy and fighting your enemy, in the case of Syria, this most recent announcement from the Taliban shows that in Syria, where we're providing arms again quietly through other countries, that in one place we're hunting down the Taliban and sending cruise missiles against them to kill them, and the other place we're providing them with the missiles and with the weapons that they are using, simultaneously manufacturing our enemy and killing, shattering this. Talking about the Pakistani Taliban, they made an announcement that they had decided to join the cause, sending hundreds of fighters into Syria to fight alongside of their Mujahideen friends. When our brothers need our help, we sent hundreds of fighters along with our Arab friends, one commander told Reuters, adding that the group would soon issue videos of what it described as their great victories in Syria. Now, so the Taliban is on the side of the rebels in Syria. They are providing jihadist Mujahideen fighters to combat the Assad government. Which side is the United States on in Syria? Oh, we're on the side of the rebels. And through Saudi Arabia and Qatar, we're providing the weapons that have changed that from a peaceful demonstration to a civil war that has killed now over 100,000 people. So here in Syria, the United States and the Taliban are on the same side. We're actually providing weapons to the Syrians indirectly through Qatar and through Saudi Arabia, and then in Afghanistan and in Pakistan, we're either sending our warplanes over them to kill them, or we are sending our drones. So how can a government be moral? How can it be rational when on one side of the equation, we're saying you are our enemy, you are the primary target in our war against terrorism. You are absolutely the primary target. The reason we're engaged in the Middle East is to fight the Taliban on one hand, and on the other hand, say that we're on the side of the rebels in Syria when they are comprised of Taliban. We were talking during the break, Scott and I, about the conditions in Israel and the fact that a senator made the announcement that both this president and his predecessor have made, that there is a two-state solution and that the only solution is a two-state solution in Israel. Now, think about that for a moment. That means that what we want to do is we want to reward terrorism with an independent state. We want to say that people who have no racial identity, no racial heritage, no national heritage, no, the mythical people known as the Palestinians are just Arab Muslims. They have no more claim to Israel than they have to any other Islamic nation surrounding them. But what we want to do is we want to first buy into the myth that there is such thing as a Palestinian people. We want to buy into the myth that there's a place called Palestine. So we want to embrace those two lies. And then what we want to do is to give the Muslim terrorists, to reward them, land. We want to give them land. What is it that the Muslims surrounding Israel have too much of? They have 99.8% of the land in the Middle East. They have too much land. So why would you, as a solution, say, we ought to take land from Israel that has too little of it, it's a little bigger than the state of New Jersey. We ought to take land from Israel that has too little of it, instead of settling this mythical people, these terrorists, in the Sinai, in western Syria. They're the majority, the people that claim to be Palestinians are a two-thirds majority in Jordan. Why not just oppose the Jordanian king and call Jordan Palestine? It's already two-thirds of the people there. When we go before Israel's formation in 1948, and the West Bank was controlled by Jordan, and in Gaza was controlled by Egypt, if the solution for this mythical people was to give them a state comprised of the West Bank and Gaza, why didn't Jordan and Egypt do it? Why didn't Jordan call the West Bank Palestine and cede control over of it to the Palestinians? And why didn't Egypt do the same thing? And why at the time didn't they make them coterminous and divide what was going to be Israel into northern and southern islands? Because it's all a fraud. It's all a hoax. It's all this giant myth that is being perpetrated on humankind to diminish their likelihood that Israel can survive. Because the world, Europe, the United States, the Russians, the Chinese have decided that, you know, the money is where our loyalties are, and oil is money, and so we're going to side with the Muslims. That's what's happening here. To ask Israel to give up land, which it has too little of, to people who have vastly too much of it, is insane. But beyond that, to trade that for promises of peace from people who have never known peace. From the moment their religion was conceived, it was a terrorist manifesto. Muhammad, in the first 10 years of the Islamic era, led 75 savage terrorist raids. In the first 100 years after his death, Muslims killed hundreds of millions of people, ravaging as barbarians everything from India to the outskirts of Europe and northern and western Africa. This is the most savage religion ever conceived by humankind. It is responsible today for 99% of all terrorist attacks. And so from these people, you're going to trade land, which Israel has too little of, and the Muslims already have too much of, for promises of peace from a people who have known nothing but terror? On the face of it, the two-state solution is so irrational, so ignorant, so grotesquely immoral, so absolutely destined to fail, just like Czechoslovakia failed with Neville Chamberlain. By satiating the Nazis and giving them the high ground of Czechoslovakia, what happened? Hitler was empowered. And the Nazis, within 6 months of that time, lashed out at the world, first at Poland, and then expanding throughout Europe. The exact same thing will happen this time. And it's obvious. You know, go back 12 years ago, and George Bush was trying to deal with 9/11, and he thought that the grand solution was, let's go invade Afghanistan, and then let's invade Iraq. And at the time, even before troops went into either of those two countries, I said, this is suicidal. It's obvious that by doing these things, we're going to make very bad situations much worse. And every aspect of what happened in Afghanistan and Iraq, I predicted what would occur. And it occurred just as I said it would. It doesn't mean that I'm a prophet. I'm not. It means that if you examine the history of these people, if you evaluate the circumstances and you use evidence and reason, you can conclude, come up with a conclusion that is inevitable. We had no chance whatsoever to make the bad situation that existed in Afghanistan better. We had no chance whatsoever of making the bad situation that existed in Iraq better. And in fact, the moment we committed to invading those countries, we committed suicide. Because the consequence of invading those countries was to destabilize Pakistan, pushing the fundamentalist Muslims out of Afghanistan into Pakistan, which is a country with nuclear weapons, and we would eliminate Iran's only enemy in Iraq, and allow them to complete their nuclear ambitions and to have greater influence over the Middle East. It was suicidal. And it was obvious that that's the way it was going to turn out. But no one would listen. Oh, no. Got that same lame argument. Well, they flew planes in our building. What are you going to do? Nothing? No, you can explain. Here's what you can do that will actually have the desired effect, that is guaranteed to produce a favorable outcome. I don't want any part of that, no. We become a nation that hits first and never asks questions. Even now, Americans can't deal with the fact that our invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq were horribly misguided, that we made bad situations worse and squandered a million lives and $6 trillion worth of gold in the process, bankrupting our country, destroying our whatever moral credibility we had in the world. It is easy to predict what's going to happen, just as it is in Israel. If the United States has its way, and we force Israel to give up the high ground of Judea and Samaria, called the West Bank today, to these Muslims and then allow these Muslims to connect the West Bank and Gaza, dividing Israel in two at the waist, narrowing it and making it vulnerable to its enemies at its waist, where 70% of Israelis live, to less than 20 miles. What do you think the Hamas Muslims are going to do? And we know we gave them Gaza. They decided, hey, the really cool thing to do is let's fire rockets into Israeli towns. We know that before the fence, and the PLO, Fatah, Alaska Martyrs Brigade terrorists were running amok inside of Israel. We know what they did. They murdered Jewish women and children. So what are they going to do when they have their own country, build up their own military, have their own weapons? What do you suppose is going to happen? And this be the exact same thing that happened in World War II. Imagine now the U.S.-equipped militaries of Saudi Arabia, of Kuwait, of Pakistan, of Iraq, of all of these nations, even now with the weapons that we're funneling into Syria, the weapons that we provide for Egypt, the weapons we provided indirectly for Libya, all brought to bear on Israel, all at her waist where 70% of the people live, fighting at her and shooting at her from both sides. What's going to happen? Oh, welcome back to Shattering Mist. I'm your host, Yetta. Some days ago, I came across an article in the New York Times, which is one of many that is signifying that the U.S. government isn't just interested in spying on us by monitoring all of our internet clicks, by monitoring all of our cell phone conversations, but also through the deployment of drones. Now, of course, we have been told that, oh, no, drones are only for those terrorists, those bad guys out there. They're not for America. Well, it now appears that there are tens of thousands of drones that have either been deployed or in the process of being deployed in this country. Well, this particular article speaks of the drones that will be deployed on the border. It says, as Congress considers a new immigration law that would expand the fleet of unmanned drones along the border, expands it now, not just begins the use of drones there, the agency in charge of border protection is increasingly offering the drones it already owns to a variety of law enforcement agencies. Well, you see, we'll authorize the spending of money for drones for border protection because, boy, Americans really like that. Okay, no problem. You can use the drones for border protection. What happened to them? Well, they went and got licensed to law enforcement. And so law enforcement now has the ability to fly drones around and spy on anybody they want. Great, huh? According to this article, it has considered equipping them with non-lethal weapons. That's the new request. You see, it's one thing to spy on people, but it's another thing altogether to be able to control them. What are the non-lethal weapons? Combination of two things. Tear gas, which is what it was used to end the peaceful protest in Turkey, American tear gas. It is what is being used, deployed now by the military in Egypt to keep people from protesting the fact that there was a military coup against a democratically elected leader. And so they want to put tear gas on them, and they want to put shotgun-propelled pellets so that it's to be in a Gatling gun kind of format to shoot rubber bullets. Now, why would they need that? Why would you need tear gas and a Gatling gun of rubber bullets in your drone for law enforcement? Are they not devices that are used to keep people from gathering large crowds? Does the government realize that, you know, there might be a limit to the number of times that they lie, cheat, and steal from and to the American people, that maybe there is the possibility that ultimately somebody someday might wake up and say, you know, I'm not going to take it anymore, and that they need to be equipped to immediately suppress any uprising. And what better way to do it than to rain pellets and tear gas down from the sky? It's another sign that the enemy of America, from the government's point of view, are Americans. The agencies that have used the 10 Predator drones owned by the Customs and Border Protection Agency have deployed them to investigate fishing violations, to search for missing persons, and to inspect levees along the Mississippi River. Isn't that lovely? And, you know, of course, you need tear gas and you need rubber pellets to weaponize these drones just in case, Bambi goes on a rampage? Just in case you need to fill the gap in the levee, and what better way to do it than fill it through full of rubber bullets? Well, in the documents, the Border Patrol said the data collected by the drones could be shared with other government agencies, raising concerns about the privacy of Americans within the nation's borders. Yeah, no kidding, Sherlock. Additionally, the agency, in a 2010 report to Congress, included in the documents, raised the possibility of eventually equipping its drones with non-lethal weapons to immobilize people and vehicles. Perfect, huh? In a statement on Wednesday, the agency said it has no plans currently to arm its unmanned aircraft systems with non-lethal weapons or weapons of any kind. And, of course, we should trust them, right? This is the same government that says we're not spying on Americans and then admitted, oh, well, I did lie. We were spying on Americans. This is the same government that swore to uphold the Constitution that wishes to undermine it at every possible occasion. Well, we'll return to Shattering Myths after the top of the hour news, and we're going to turn our attention back to the Torah and to the Shabbat of Yahweh.